Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast.
Welcome back to Bookbound. This is Jessica, and I am joined at the mic by Mari Garza and Cheryl Lindemann, and we are joined by Laura, who is a library assistant at our Okemos branch. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We have a bunch of broad-ranging topics and titles to share with you today, but I think we're just going to dive in.
Yeah.
I think we got a lot to cover. And, we have a little bit of a mystery theme.
Yes, we do. I have some picture books that I am really interested in promoting. If you are an Agatha Christie fan, as some of my younger family members are lately, I'm just so excited to see little kids in my family getting into mysteries at the, you know, upper grade school, middle school age. But what I have is the first one is Lady Pancake and Sir French Toast, Who Donut, A Holiday Mystery. Miss Maple is a beloved character by Agatha Crispy.
Of course.
She has a new book, and she's invited friends to this holiday eve gathering. You had to have a special invite to come. And the setting is Gingerbread Mansion.
Well, of course.
But just as about, you know, Miss Maple is about to start, the lights go out. And the book disappears. This was just hilarious because you've got all these characters, including Elvis Parsley, Count Caper, you've got Biscotti Cookie Helper. I mean, all these special servants and invite special guests who are here at the story, and they're all trying to figure out what happened to the book. So it kind of reminded me a little bit of Clue, if you remember that story. But this was just so, so funny. I really, really liked it. And, you know, Lady Pancake and Sir French Toast is an ongoing series. So okay. There's lots to this. And this is by Josh Funk. I forgot to mention that. Illustrated by Brendan Carney. So if you still are interested in Agatha Christie, this is a mini mystery called The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, written by Marcy K. Monson and Greg, illustrated by Greg Papraki. This is actually more of a, it's a little meatier, I would say. It's not, you know, a chapter book or anything, but it's a picture book with a lot of content. There are puzzles and games and activities to figure out.
It is an adaptation.
Yes, it is an adaptation. It's I think, pretty true to the original story, but something else that I think would appeal to, you know, maybe a third or fourth grader, really nice. And then I go on and on because I love the concept of mysteries in a setting of picture books because it gets kids really thinking about, like, well, what could happen next? And just why did the chicken cross the road? A hard-boiled mystery. This one is by Brianna Kaplan-Sayers. And this is about Inspector H. Poulet, who has a new case on the wings. The chicken has apparently crossed the road. I don't know. I find these puns, maybe they will get more laughs from adults than really from children, but the illustrations are just really fun to see chickens with these, like, looks of on their faces. That might not have come through. But anyway, I hope you'll check these out. The other one that I thought I would pass on is about, by Mark Teague, The Farmer in the Dell. I mean, just, that one's not coming out till March, but I got to look at it earlier online, and it's these are really fun books.
So, Madi, do you think that these are, that mystery is sort of an underrepresented area in mystery?
In picture books?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I would say totally underrepresented. There are a lot out there, but that's not usually what we see in publishing.
So, okay, I have a mystery romance historical type thing. Cheryl was looking at the cover and it was sort of reminding her of those old kind of Regency mystery styles. And it is All of Us Murderers by K.J. Charles. I'm a fan of J.K. Charles's romances. She writes historical romance, usually male leads. And this one is really more of a gothic mystery, bordering on horror and a touch to it. You find the main character, Zeb, summoned to a wealthy manor, and he's sort of realizing it's way out, kind of in the middle of nowhere, and it's gray, England, away from the village, away from everything, and it's getting kind of more and more like, why did I agree to do this? What's happening here? He's agreed to go and visit, I think it's a cousin, who had invited him for a period of time, and he just felt compelled to actually go. But then he finds out when he gets there, it's all the family members he does not want to ever be around ever. His older brother is pushy. There's a cousin. The homeowner lord has a ward who's fine, but he's basically pulled all these people together and told them, one of you is going to marry this woman because I want this house entailed to her, and we're not leaving until this is settled. It's a very, and added to the mix is Zeb's ex, who is now the secretary for the manor, and they parted not well, and of course nobody's supposed to know anything about them, just based on timing or the period, but there's humor in it, despite it being a very kind of dark sort of setting in a sense. There's a strange mystery to this. Zeb, it's a really nice, pre-general diagnosis, but Zeb is very neurodivergent, brilliant in his own way, but also the person that cannot, leaves things everywhere and just is, it's portrayed in a way that just does well, and the help that Gideon gives him in the past and in the book as it happens is really interesting and thoughtful. But it's just a very, it's suspenseful. There's a lot going on. There's stories that both is the idea that there may be a haunting. There's the idea that there may be something going on that's just sort of crazy. And it's just a well done, again, it's sort of crossing that line of gothic mystery, gothic horror, with a touch of romance on it in there as well. So I highly suggest it. It's All of Us Murders by K.J. Charles.
All right. I think I have the next two, I believe. We're going right down the track of the mysteries here. I am going to start off by saying that all of my picks have dogs because that's just the kind of person I am. So if you like mystery and you like dogs, this is the book for you. If you don't like mystery but you like dogs, this is the book for you. Anyway, so my first one is actually a series. It's called The Finders, the Trilogy by Jeffrey B. Burton. And I like it for a lot of reasons, not just because it's about dogs, but dogs are the main theme. Burton, in general, is one of my favorite writers. He's currently working on his third series, which starts with The Dead Years and also involves dogs. And that series is also just as wonderful. But The Finders starts off very sad with this tiny little golden retriever puppy who is horrifyingly gassed in a garage. And a policewoman, Kippy, barely gets her out in time. Our main protagonist is Mace, and he decides to adopt this puppy and name her Vyra. The thing about Mace is that he trains cadaver dogs, so dogs that are used to search for dead bodies by the police by pinpointing the scent of a specific compound that releases when bodies begin decomposing. He's got, I think, like 4 or 5 of them, and they're all cadaver dogs, so Vyra fits in perfectly. Without giving too much of the plot away, while they're training Vyra, he and Kippy, who has joined the party, discovers that Vyra has this very particular talent. A typical dog has over 100 million scent receptors. In addition to using the choice cadavers, Vyra is also able to pick up on the discrete scent that is left behind on a body from the person that killed them. I guess this is really rare. I did some research into it. It's a real phenomena. It's just super rare, so that's cool. But so Vyra knows who the killers are in these books. She recognizes them just by their scent, And it's just a matter of either tracking them down or, in the second book, getting to prove that they are guilty. It's professionally realistic dialogue. The emotions are just wonderful. And the thing I love most about it is how the author writes two perspectives in all of his books. You get the story from the protagonist, which is Mace in this scenario, but then you also get the side of the story from the perpetrator. So in The Finders, you get all this action, you get all this comedy being told by Mace and his crazy dogs, but then you also get the killer's justifications and views on why and how he's doing these things. And don't worry, he doesn't usually give the killer away to the reader. The second book is a little bit different, but in the first book, the killer refers to himself as Everyman because he's just so ordinary. There's nothing about him. He's just like every other man. So everything is just told by other, every man does this or something along those lines. It's just, it's such a great series. The characters are wonderful. The dogs are wonderful. It's just so good. So I'd really recommend it to anybody.
Cool.
Yeah, it's so fun. Very cool. I read that one, wow, maybe like 7 years ago, and it's still like one of my top three favorite books.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh,
nice.
The next one that I've got is also a mystery series. This one is the Dr. Evan Wilding series by Barbara Nicklaus. It starts off, the first book is called At First Light. It's a really unique series and has some really excellent puzzles that need to be worked out. And the book starts off with this really brutal murder, and carved near the body is a set of these mysterious etchings, which are obviously left to convey like a message of some sort. So you have Dr. Wilding, who enters now. He is a, let's see if I can say this right, semiotician, who specializes in decoding signs and symbols and uncovering the messages they're meant to portray. His understanding of semiotics, I can never say that. His understanding of that is the main concept in this series. So like in the first book, you've got these strange ruins. In the second one, someone murders someone using a cobra, and the cobra is supposed to represent something, so he's got to figure that out. So it's just really interesting. And the cool thing about it is that while he's trying to decode these things, you get like the inner workings of his mind. So like you see him going through his mind and trying to say, is this, you know, from this century, is this from this century? Like, and you get all these really cool inner workings, and he's honestly a brilliant man. So it's really cool. Like the author did some really intense research into it. It's cool. But it's fast paced. It's an original concept. And in the second book, which is Dark of Night, he is watching his friend's corgi, who he does adopt in the third book. And the corgi just is like, comes tagging along with him in all these mysteries. It's so cool. So, yeah, I really recommend it. It's really good.
I love a corgi sidekick.
That's, I know. And it's great because you don't expect him. Because in the second book, he's just kind of watching the dog. Like his friend is on vacation or whatever. And then in the third book, they open up with, he belongs to you now. And I'm like, yes. Corgi is permanent now. So he's so cute. Yeah.
I feel like a corgi and a detective are like a perfect combination.
Oh, I forgot to mention, Dr. Evan has dwarfism. So he's super short, so he's got this super short, and then he has a super short dog.
Oh, my God.
It's just so cute. It's so cute.
He sounds so good.
Yeah.
Definitely. Oh, I love that. Mm-hmm. The connection to my book is very thin. we tried it's to bundle these together with a bit of a mystery theme, but the mystery author, Dorothy L. Sayers, is one of the women that's featured in this group biography that I'm going to talk about next. So that's a little baby connection there. But the book that I want to talk about is called Square Haunting, Five Writers in London Between the Wars by Francesca Wade. And wow, this book was so good. It was my last book of the year for 2025. I'd bought it literally a year before. It sat there, and I had that little window where I could read whatever I wanted. So I usually just take a huge stack of books, and I go up to maybe like page 3 or 4, and I see what grabs me, and it completely grabbed me. So this is a group biography about five women, kind of around like a 40-year period, that all lived in Bloomsbury in London in this particular square called Mecklenburg Square, which is now Goodenough College. The buildings have been taken down that they lived in. This square was Zeppelined in World War I. It was blitzed in World War II. And in that time, these five women, who are Hilda Doolittle, or H.D., the poet, Dorothy L. Sayers, novelist and mystery writer, most famous for her book Gaudy Night, or the Lord Peter Wimsey series of books, Jane Ellen Harrison, who was a classicist, who is just absolutely fascinating, whose life really peaked at age 76, her life and her work. Ellen Power, who was amazing, Eileen Power, rather, she was a political economist who was involved with the start of the League of Nations. You name it, she was there. And Virginia Woolf, who doesn't need any introduction. There's no hagiography about Virginia Woolf either, which I liked, that her flaws are sort of presented in the book, but there's a really great chapter on her. So this book talks about this area in London, which is my favorite area, where the University of London is, where Jessica and I both did study abroads at one point. I visited back there last year, and then I went there the first time 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was going to go to Bloomsbury, I was like 20-some years old, and I'm like, I've heard of that. The Bloomsbury group, like Virginia Woolf, but I wasn't a literature major. I was a political theory major. I kind of just scratched the surface of understanding who these people were, mm-hmm. but I was like, something big happened here. And in my opinion, you can feel it when you're there. But the book talks a lot about Bloomsbury and that it was a place where women could live on their own, which was really huge in like the 1920s. They would live in these boarding houses. It was seen as kind of like a little bit seedier area of London. It was filled with activism, artists, philosophers, authors, of course, bookstores, publishing houses. And it was just like the hotbed of intellectual thought for a long time. So we have these women at the core of the story, and I don't want to talk too much more about it because it's going to take too long, but it literally was one of the best books I've ever read. And it's all about women finding their artistic and intellectual expression despite all of the odds that they faced. And a lot of really famous men interweave out in and out of the book too, Ezra Pound, you name it, they were there, they were weaving in and out, but this is really the story of the women. Mm-hmm. It's really a feminist history, and it was so inspiring. I came away from this book just in a very, very moving. The last chapter is incredibly, incredibly moving. So I highly recommend it if you're interested in London, if you're interested in feminist history, literary history, and it's just written in such an amazing way. It's one of those nonfiction books that just sweeps you along. There's nothing mm-hmm. boring in the least about it, so... That's it. Square Haunting.
Okay. We wanted to talk a bit about the reading challenge.
Yes, yeah. We do. So we do have a Get Hooked on a Good Yarn winter reading challenge this year. Starts on January 12th, goes through February 28th. It's really just, you know, enjoy winter, relax. There's some activities that go with it. We hope you'll check out our website where you can sign up on our platform. There's also a little card you can pick up in our branches if you prefer to keep track that way and then submit it. There's a number of prizes involved, but something we have traditionally been doing the last few years, just celebrating coziness themes and winter and reading.
And it's, you know, it's that reading challenge time of year. Yeah. And people, I want to say, because... We've hit the year end, and everybody posts how many books they read and all that sort of thing. Any reading is really good. We just want people to read.
Yep.
And there are activity points you can get. Baking cookies is one of the activities.
Yep. Yay!
Reading in bed, taking a walk, being a tourist in your own town. So there are a variety of other things you can do to get points besides reading
as
well.
Yes, absolutely.
So just a nice, fun incentive program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
very cool. Do you want to talk?
Yeah, so I have the next book. This is Maddie. It's a teen book, Beth is Dead by Katie Burnett. This book was actually just released on January 6th. And this is a reimagining of Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. It's a classic, obviously. But if you haven't read the original, you are going to still really like this. I think teens will really be drawn to this because the dialogue is so snappy and so quick. The setting is still Concord, Massachusetts. But in this one, we've got beautiful dear Beth. She winds up dead on a hill in the snow. There's blood. There's a blunt force trauma to her body. And it happens on New Year's Eve. I listened to this story. It's about 10 hours-ish. It was riveting, if I may say that. If, my gosh, I was like, it almost sounded a little true crime podcast-like. It was really interesting. And what I like, too, is that it's kind of back and forth. So there were like three or four narrators. And you get the perspective from each sister. Jo March is still an aspiring author in this reimagining. She also has a major social media following. Meg has gotten a full ride to Harvard. Go, Meg! She kind of still has a relationship with Mr. John Brooke. Mm-hmm. Barry on again, off again. Amy is snarky as ever and very scrappy, has the youngest March sister. And Beth, she's an amazing pianist, and she's tutored by Mr. John Brooke, too, in this story. And I really found myself thinking about her character and, like, all the swishing that has been going on in my brain over the decades of, like, you know, reading the book, watching the movies, and just her character in general. She's a very gentle person, and in my view, I thought she was ambitious. She's kind of portrayed as not being very ambitious in the story. But anyway, I think what really caught me was just how Katie Burnett, who I believe is a debut author, I'd not heard of her before, really very well, like, just kind of inserted all sorts of very contemporary themes into this story. You know, themes of privilege, about being moneyed, a moneyed person in Massachusetts, and how the March sisters are not. The cold, the woods, it was just very atmospheric in those ways. Something that really, really stood out to me was, like, you know, social media that, like, kind of uses human suffering as, like, this way to get people to engage and to click and, like, I'm like, what is it about those posts that, like, resonate so much in our society? I had to laugh because Aunt March is a record producer. I'm like thinking hip hop or something. She's still got a lot of money. Lori, the boy next door, really? Is he a suspect? No. My heart was crying just considering that one. But yeah, Mr. March. The father. I'm not going to say anything about him for now, but I just thought this was a really cool take on the classic, and I hope people will, especially teens, will pick it up.
Cool. Totally different. All right. Mm-hmm. I think I have the start of a new slight theme. My book discussion group reached the Downtown Lansing's speculative group. Just read Water Moon by Samantha Soto Yambao. She is a Filipino author. This is a book set in Tokyo, kind of. At least kind of the storefront opens up onto Tokyo. This opens with Hana inheriting a very unique pawn shop that is essentially perched on a doorway between two worlds. If you were to approach it from the outside, most people will see a ramen shop. But some people who open the door and walk through find themselves in this pawn shop. And the owners of this pawn shop are tasked with bargaining, conning people out of their regrets. And sort of take moments in their life that they've been angsting over, and telling them, well, you don't need to actually keep that. We can take that for you. But people don't understand quite what that entails and what they're actually giving away when they do that. It's the possibilities of ever kind of seeing through, you know, revisiting things, learning from it, so that sort of thing. But it's even more than that as you go along in the story. You learn more about what's going on. Hana, it's the first day. Her father has retired. She's in charge now. She's slightly hungover, as they did drink a bit last night. It's kind of sort of a celebration, and also she's dreading being the person in charge now. But she wakes up in the living space above the shop and thinks it is way too quiet. And she ends up going downstairs, and the shop has been ransacked. The front door is wide open. Her father is missing. And so is the last regret that they took in the previous day. And the thing about this is that they're not really the owners. They're just sort of charged with the pawn shop. There are some dark, scary things that come through and collect the regrets and take them into their world. And they do show up saying, hey, we'll be back, and we need all of the regrets, including the one that's missing. You need to get that for us, or else. So begins a quest. She's trying to figure out what happened to her father. She's trying to figure out what happened to this regret. And she's greeted at the door. Sort of as all of this is happening, somebody comes to the door again, expecting the ramen shop, and walks into the pawn shop and wants to help because he's looking around and saying, can we call the police? What's going on? She's like, no, you can't. The police aren't, this isn't that sort of thing. And he just won't go away. So he ends up going on this quest with her to find her father and sort of figure out what's going on. And there's a lot to it. There's a lot of family within her family, regrets and missteps and things of her history that she doesn't know. And she really wants to know what's going on with her father and what this has to do with her mother, who she never knew, and only knew that her mother somehow screwed up sometime and was punished by these dark, scary things. So there's a lot of, but it's a very strange and interesting magic system that is created in this world. They travel. Sometimes they're just jumping into a pool of water and it kind of sends them someplace else. Sometimes they're traveling by rumor, which is a weird and interesting thing that they add in. Sometimes there is a paper magic that is being done. One of her closest friends is an origami artist and creates all sorts of things that come alive and do things. So there's just a lot going on to it. It is a first fantasy novel. She's written more of the kind of the cozy Japanese style story that is very popular before, and this is a new twist for her. I thought it was very well done. It was one of the bigger books coming out of 2024. I think it was like Barnes & Noble's big pick at the end of 2024. And I just would suggest people give it a try. And she actually has another book coming out this month, I think, as well. So, and I will kind of head and give that one a try as well.
It's really good.
Yeah, it does. All right, I have the next one. It actually is also about a young woman who goes on this quest to save one of her family members. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about Nettle and Bone by T. Keene Fisher. T. Keene Fisher, in general, is one of my absolute favorite authors. I've read a ton of her books. I started off reading most of her horror, which is a really unique style of horror because I consider it like cozy horror. But anyway, so this is actually a fantasy book that she read or that she wrote, and it starts off with this convent raised but princess born Mara, who is on this quest to save her sister who was married off to a foreign land to this super jerky, horribly abusive, quite literally magically blessed husband who is the king. So along this, the whole story is led pretty much by character development, which T. Keene Fisher does like top tier. Mm-hmm. Like her character development is always like incredible. And this book has very little world building. It's almost entirely character driven. So you've got like this bizarre misshapen group and they go on this quest. So you've got a grave witch and she has a possessed chicken. Literally has a demon living inside of her. You've got this disgraced knight from some faraway land. You've got a bone dog, here's the dog again, who was literally strung together by Mara's own hands. And then you've got this kind of sort of fairy godmother who honestly is going through an identity crisis and seems to have been going through that for a long time. Yeah. So there's all these crazy characters, and they all just fit together so well, and they all go on this quest to save Mara's sister from this husband. So the goal of the quest is to kill him. So that's, they need every single one of them to do it. But Nettle and Bone, I will say, there's, in the beginning of the book, it starts off in this world that has a lot of cannibalism in it. I just want to say that the book is not about that. It mentions it in the first chapter, and then there is no more cannibalism. So if you get turned off by that, don't put the book down. It's a lie. The story is not set there. But I promise there's nothing of that in the book. But it's really a very cozy fantasy book. There's all these like little things going on. Like you have this little chicken that the fairy godmother has accidentally cursed. And it's just a really good book. And again, her character development is top tier. So if you like cozy fantasy, I'd really recommend it. And also, like I said, T. Kim Fisher does write a lot of horror. So if you're looking to branch out to a new genre, I'd really recommend her because it's like cozy horror. The thing that I like most about all of her books, aside from the character development, is that for a lot of the chapters, you have pretty normal goings. And then when you get to like the climax of the book, everything just goes nuts. And this happens in every single one of the books that I've read. And you're like, oh, I know what's going to happen. And then everything is just insane. And it ties up really well. So it's such a fun read. All of her books are really great. I just can't recommend her enough. Mm-hmm. If you want to start reading her, Nedlin Bone is really good. If you want to look in, well, that's what I'm talking about. But anyway, if you want to look into her horror, I'd recommend The Twisted Ones or A House with Good Bones. They're all really good.
Excellent.
She's wonderful, and she's very, very popular with our titles. Yes, absolutely wonderful.
See, I saw that you mentioned her on one of your other podcasts, and I was like, I read that book.
Yes, absolutely.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, sort of in the speculative vein, but going a little bit more into just fiction with the speculative, or it's dystopian fiction, we shall say. I'm going to talk about Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. And it took me a really long time to read him. I watched Remains of the Day, didn't read that book. But this is actually his book that sold the most copies, more so than The Remains of the Day. It was from 2005, and I won't be able to say too much about it. I'm just going to say a little bit. So we have a boarding school, really beautiful, picturesque setting in England. And you have sort of this boarding school feeling of, you know, you've got these young people who are sort of falling in love a bit. They've got some jealousies, rivalries, a lot of emotion, a first-person narration from our main character named Kathy. And you get introduced to Ruth and Tommy, who are really the closest people to her in the story. So they're going through the motions at Hailsham. You got to meet some of the faculty who are some of them very sympathetic to these kids and get to know them pretty well. And they make this art, and the art gets taken away. They get to make it, and then it gets taken away. Make it and taken away. So the story, as it starts to unravel, you get really enmeshed in their emotions. It's very much a coming-of-age type of story. But there's this melancholy and this haunting and this strangeness, and you start to realize that these people are living in a future where their biomedicine is very advanced, and they're not going to live a normal life, but they're just like us. They have those feelings and emotions, and so that's the stage that's laid, and if I say any more, I'll give away the whole point of the book, but I highly recommend you read it. I'm so glad I did. You may have already seen the movie. There's a movie based off of it. There's actually a play. There's a Japanese multi-part series based off of it, so it's very inspiring. Apparently, it's used in a lot of classrooms and literature classrooms. It's one of those books where you finish it and you're like, I need to talk to somebody about this immediately. But I said I really haven't been able to do that yet. But I these people, they stick in your head. Mm-hmm. They run around in your brain. And it was just really amazing. And I think it might have some sideways interest for people who like dark academia and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's different than The Secret History or something like that. But it has that. The absolute like boarding school feeling, you know, that really strong feeling, and then that strange something is not right melancholy right from pretty much the first page.
I'm very curious, maybe because I actually haven't read Never Let Me Go either, but I've read Clara and the Sun, and I think that there's some interesting there can be some interesting discussion between the two. So maybe if one of each of us read those, then we can have a good discussion about that.
Especially in this day and age with everything going on with technology.
Yes, absolutely. I think I've got the last book.
Yeah.
All right. So this maybe should have gone a little bit closer to Square Hunting. But I've got I periodically get asked to do kind of surveys of things coming out and really kind of look at, you know, just really kind of get an idea of what are the trends coming out in books. And this past fall, I did that, or late summer, did that for fall reading and came across this book called Queer Enlightenments, The Hidden History of Lovers, Lawbreakers, and Homemakers. It's by Antony Delaney. He's an Irish historian. And it just, it caught my eye. I was really curious. We got it, but I kind of wanted to do, it's one of those things where I wanted to do the audiobook because I thought that might be a bit better way for me to get into it. It is a really well done history of queer, it looks at like 11 different stories during the Georgian period in British history. So it's like runs from 1726 to about 1836. But it's sort of like, you know, people argue about when do queer people start existing? And, short answer, always. But it's sort of, he's pulling out of the archives out and really, really going through and looking at lives and seeing where people have been literally scribbled out, or where they have managed, you know, it's there, but people just aren't kind of looking at it the way they should. And I will say it's kind of a harrowing opening in that it opens with the raid of what had been a queer safe coffee house in London, and it walks you through all the consequences for the group of people who are picked up in that raid. Get past that. It is dark. But all of the stories show such, moments of joy, which is wonderful, but also just the tenacity, the people building communities for themselves, households for themselves. It has, you know, the people at the coffee house are probably, they're more, they are like, one is a milkman, one is a butcher, they're working people. There are examples of kind of landed gentry who have created their communities for themselves. There is Lord Hervey, who was in the highest echelons of power in London during his period. It includes a pair of women who created their own utopia in Wales, and they in turn inspired Anne Lister in her quest to find a wife. And to settle her, she's interesting. If you haven't come across Gentleman Jack by Ann Choma or the Gentleman Jack series on PBS, this goes more into depth on her and shows her, it shows everybody as more multifaceted and more human and not just, you know, not just a queer icon that, you know, they got married here. But it is very, it's just very interesting and it's enlightening. It actually ranges from, it's very centered on the Georgian period, but we've got characters, things happening in London, Wales, Paris, New York City, people moving back and forth, moving across into Europe at different times on their grand tour. But also people moving to the States for a better life, and there's a couple essentially a trans man marries in industrial setting. She's like ends up marrying the like a boss's daughter. And they just move to the United States and start their life. And it, you know, they come up and they get caught once, but they seem to go on afterwards. They never show up in the records again. And he just sort of chooses to believe that they were trying to be under the radar and they never show back up as being caught again. And sort of, it's an interesting look and really eye-opening, really well-written, and it just sort of listening to the stories as they develop. So I just highly recommend it. And again, that's Queer Enlightenments by Antony Delaney.
I agree. This would really have gone nicely adjacent to Square Haunting, different century. But mm-hmm. the themes of, erasure. Like some mm-hmm. of these women, their family destroyed of their letters and that sort of thing. So there were obvious relationships that were allowed to be, as women were allowed to be, exist in England. Gay men, there was a law against them being right. together, but women were allowed. And one of the reasons they touch on in this book why women were allowed is that, well, if let's not call attention to it so that women don't want to be together. We might as well not make the law because it might call attention to this idea of being a lesbian. That was a delightful part of the book, sarcasm. But there's a lot of these women's relationships and very sustaining relationships. In particular, I lost my note on that one, but Jane Ellen Harrison's relationship was particularly interesting. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, the Bloomsbury group, you know. But.
Yeah, and the couple that end up in Wales is quite fascinating, and their effect on Anne Lister's story is really interesting. And one of the things he kind of expresses is that post-Gentleman Jack, so after that book has already come out and after the stuff, there are people who have been continuing to work on the story of Anne Lister's wife and found, sort of in the archives, finally found some of her writing that had been sort of lost, kind of attached to, I think it was in part of Anne's records, but it had been kind of mistaken for, or just sort of buried. Yeah. And so you now get sort of the opposite side of the story in some ways. And it's just, I just found it really interesting. I'm at heart an archivist and a historian. That's sort of where I trained. So this is just a right up my alley in that sense.
Yeah, I remember that was really well reviewed when I got that to buy. I was like, wow, this looks really good. So. All right.
Go forth, read more, and do activities. Yeah. You know, join our reading challenge.
Make some cookies.
And
do some knitting.
Yes, all that.
Thanks.